Hello and welcome to Mind You, episode 4, presented by Michael Bloomfield and Fahana Mann.
Today we are going to be talking about brains, bugs and drugs. Michael, how have you been this week?
Fahana, I've been really well, thanks. How have you been?
I've been all right. I was thinking we could carry on our approach of bringing in a blockbuster nice and early. Have you seen anything interesting in the movies lately?
I went to see Jurassic World.
Ooh.
At the IMAX.
I haven't seen that.
It's very, very good. It's very good fun. And it was in 3D.
Ooh.
And it was amazing. And part of the reason why, well, the honest reason why I went to see it is because I wanted to watch it because I really like Jurassic Park.
This wasn't like one of those things we did for our partners like last week.
Well, no, but
This is what you're into.
I did go with my partner and I absolutely loved it. The thing that it made me think about was what we were talking about in last week's episode.
Ah, which bit? The milk? The migrants?
Well, the monsters.
Ah, okay.
The monsters and our need for monsters. And because we were very, very psychoanalytic,
quite Freudian. I think we invented that word last time, didn't we?
It was really interesting because it made me think about our need for monsters and the fact that we need to look to the past for our monsters, which is what Jurassic World's all about.
Ah, so you recommend?
I recommend. Great fun. Basically, a bit like the first one, but with a new special dinosaur.
Oh, and lots of special effects.
Lots of special effects. And at the end of the day, it's in 3D, so you just can't beat dinosaurs coming at you in 3D.
No, you probably can't, Not even underwater. What was it? Slugs we did last time. Giant squid. No, giant squid.
Giant squid, giant squid, giant squid. They do have a giant sea monster, though. A giant sea dinosaur.
A 3D giant sea dinosaur. Don't give it away. Don't spoil
I'm not it giving anything away because this is in the trailer.
Okay, fine.
But it eats a shark.
Right, you're giving too much away now. Don't ruin it for me.
Thinking about my shark phobia last week.
I like what we're doing. We're tying things nice and neatly.
We are. It's all interlinked. It's all interlinked.
It's just how it's flowing.
Fahana, what have you been up to?
Well,
apart from working really hard.
Yeah, well, you're doing that too. We're both working very hard and it's very hot right now.
It's very hot in London, which is good.
That might explain why we go slightly off topic every now and then.
I think so.
It's just too hot in this
room.
Our
brains are actually melting.
Yes, but we'll get to brains in a minute. I want to share my movie experience of the week. It was slightly different to yours. This was a film that I actually watched a free screening of at Birkbeck. It was advertised on the Royal College of Psychiatrists website, and it's called Abandoned Goods. It's a short essay film written by Pia Borg and Edward Lawrenson. And I actually got to meet Edward Lawrenson because he was there afterwards and shared his kind of reflections on the film.
Oh, wow. What was the film about?
Well, I'll quote from their website. It's about the extraordinary collection of artworks created by patients detained in the Netherlands Psychiatric Hospital between 1946 and 1981. And these were actually pieces that were created in a pioneering art studio in that hospital run by the artist Edward Adamson. Now, I mean, there were lots more originally, but now about 5,500 pieces survive, and together they're known as the Adamson Collection, one of the major bodies of British asylum art, as it's known. The film explores the transformation of the objects in the Adamson Collection from clinical material, which is what they originally were, to revered art objects. And it was made with the help of psychiatrist Dr. David O'Flynn. It's won lots of awards internationally. It was very atmospheric, very moving. And I have to say, one of the interesting things was that, as I said, one of the co-directors was there afterwards taking questions from the audience. And one of the questions that was asked that I was thinking about the whole way through was the sort of ethics of using and displaying this artwork when the people who created the works actually never gave their consent for it to be used in that way. It was created in a very therapeutic kind of one-to-one
environment. I see, so it's because when I went to see an exhibition a few years ago now,
yes,
that I think was in the South Bank Centre at the Royal Festival Hall, and it was a special temporary exhibition that was put up by works of art from patients from Broadmoor Hospital.
Okay.
And Broadmoor Hospital is a special hospital. It's a secure hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And that was absolutely fascinating. But of course, with those paintings were put forward with a view to exhibit them. So when the patients were creating their art, they knew that it would go to potentially be exhibited. But of course, that's quite different from what you're describing. And I think that does raise quite a few ethical questions. But on the other hand, I think it can also provide a unique window and unique perspective into some of the human experiences. And I guess from an ethical point of view, on the one hand, as a general principle, we would want to respect our patients' anonymity mm-hmm. and confidentiality. Mm-hmm. Whilst on the other hand, if someone has created a work of art, they have the intellectual property to it. So I think it does raise some very real ethical questions, but also some very interesting ethical questions.
It does. And I have to say, at the end of it, I was left with a feeling that it was done very thoughtfully, and I would thoroughly recommend people watch it if they can. I mean, what was impressive was that the director actually stood there and took the question and reflected on it and said, look, we did think about this, and at the end of the day we had to make a decision, either we show it or we don't, and that was a decision we made, but I totally respect that there are arguments either way, which I thought was very impressive. You were talked through, there was a kind of narrator talking through each of the pieces and who, and then they would sort of cut in clips of psychiatrists from the time discussing maybe some of what was going on with different patients, ideas that were around at the time about, mm-hmm. say, schizophrenic patients using red more than others and what that might mean. And of course, you hear those theories, and it's important to reflect on kind of the history of psychiatry, I think, for everybody who's involved.
And really, but how it's moved on.
Yeah,
I
we've
guess.
Come a long way. Definitely is one of the things that you can see when watching this film. And that's an important message to take away. But it's also a theme that we've been coming across in a number of different areas, isn't it? And how far we've come in terms of equality.
Marriage equality has been in the press recently, and I think we can't forget the fact that it's only been a few decades ago that homosexuality was still considered, apart from being illegal,
yes.
from our perspectives as psychiatrists, it was considered a mental illness.
It was a category you could diagnose somebody with.
You could diagnose someone as being mentally ill by virtue of their homosexuality. There was a move really in that came about with social changes in the 1960s, but really in the 1970s to change that, and it was only in the 80s and early 90s that it was taken out of the main diagnostic tools that we use. That's the DSM, which is the American Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, and the ICD-10, which is the World Health Organization's International Classification of Diseases.
Well done.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. So it came out of the classification, and of course, equality and equal rights has been something that many people in society have fought for over the years and are still fighting for. And the recent vote by the Supreme Court in the United States of America to legalise same-sex marriages is seen by many people as being a victory for equality, although, of course, it remains very controversial to some people. Mm-hmm. But certainly from my point of view, I view it in the context of equality. Of course, with equal rights come equal responsibilities.
Yes.
And something that's been very concerning recently was a report that is going out on the BBC by Mubeen Azar.
Yes, what was this about? You were just mentioning it earlier.
This was a special report which looked into the phenomena of chemsex.
What's chemsex?
Chemsex is a slang term that's used in the British gay scene, particularly the London gay scene,
okay.
to describe having a sexual encounter under the influence of chemicals. So chem is short for chemicals. So it's having sex with people under the influence of drugs, and quite strong drugs, and drugs that we would be quite concerned about as psychiatrists.
What kinds of drugs are we talking about?
GHB.
Right, okay.
Methadrone.
Okay.
And sometimes crystal meth, cocaine and amphetamines mixed with Viagra. And there seems to be a growing trend now, and really fueled by some of the changes that are happening in social media, for example, being able to find someone to have anonymous sex with on an app.
Mm.
And
is that on the increase, you think, that approach to meeting?
I think that is on the increase. And I think particularly for younger generations, it's quite concerning, because I think for young people who, even in Britain, which is an extremely tolerant and liberal society mm-hmm. compared to other countries and societies,
there,
I think for many people who grow up there, who grow up and they are gay or bisexual or have a non-normative sexuality,
mm-hmm.
that they can perhaps grow up with a sense of not revealing their true selves to other people.
Okay.
And have a sense that there's something about them that's a bit different, or even perhaps a bit wrong. And then when they become adults, they then are faced with a very normalised, overtly sexual way of behaving, in the context of drugs, which is also anonymous. So it becomes very normal to meet someone who you don't know and have sex with them and then not see them again, potentially. And of course, this has many ramifications, and I think it's important for us to think about, but as psychiatrists, because of course, the literature tells us that gay men, lesbian women, are more likely to experience problems with their mental health. There are higher rates of depression, anxiety disorder, self-harm and suicide. One of the interesting things, and one of the shocking things about this, is that I think for some people, there's, at a superficial level, they would say that it's a sexually liberal behaviour for them to do. But that might betray a sense of actually having a really understandable human need for intimacy, and only being able to experience that in a drug-induced state with strangers, and not in the context of a longer-term relationship, where partners are there not just to provide you with sexual gratification, but to provide you with emotional support and look after some of your other needs as well, that of course all of us have.
So that's a kind of, I guess, I mean, there's an interest, I agree, those are kind of thoughtful reflections on the kind of psychology of it and then the sort of social aspect of it. What do we know about what's going on at a kind of neurochemical level? What's it about? I mean, taking the drugs, and is this about getting highs? I mean, what is it about?
Well, I think if you ask people why they take drugs, the reason that they tell you is that they enjoy taking the drug.
They like the high, or they like the feeling.
They like the feeling. Now, it's a bit of an oversimplification, but all of us have a chemical in our brains called dopamine. Mm-hmm. When we take drugs, the amount of dopamine in our brain increases. There's more dopamine released from a part of our brain called the striatum.
And that's a rewarding kind of feeling?
That gives us a feeling of reward and is linked to feelings of pleasure.
Yeah.
And it's thought that dopamine is also involved in sex. And
not just in humans.
From what you've been reading. Because there was a very interesting study written by Chai Feng Fu of National Qinan University in Nantou, Taiwan.
Just for the record, he read that off the screen, did not say that from memory.
Thank you for that.
I decided to keep these things.
I thought I was doing really well.
You did.
And their team published that paper in Nature Communications. This was a study that looked at older fruit flies.
The fruit flies are back.
The fruit
what
flies
do the
are back.
Fruit flies bring us this time.
Well, all of us, many of us, when we were medical students, had to study or at least learn about fruit flies and
their genes.
Drosophila malangosta. And as an aside, one of my friends at medical school who I sat next to
wasn't a fruit fly. Oh, that would be a good story.
But she used to. It would be a very good story. She's a very good friend of mine. And one thing that she said as a joke was that she would name a daughter Drosophila because she thought it was such a good name.
Aww. I know lots of people called Melina, which actually is when you bleed from your back passage.
It's very smelly, very smelly poo. It is a name. Anyway, so back to flies.
This has nothing to do with Melina.
The study reported that in more elderly flies who are 40 days old, that when they increase the amounts of dopamine in their brains, they perform elaborate dances that involve tapping, licking, and playing a love song with wing vibrations in order to court their female partners.
And we have a little clip of that song right now. No, we don't really.
We don't. Unfortunately, we should get one. So, Professor Chai Feng Fu, if you're listening, if you can send us a tape of that recording, that would be much appreciated.
That was a serious scientist moment, that, wasn't it?
It was. Of course, our dopamine levels go down when we get older, so it's thought that by increasing the amount of dopamine, that it can increase sexual behaviour. And we see this clinically because for some patients who have Parkinson's disease, one of the side effects of using medicine that increases the levels of dopamine, and Parkinson's disease is caused by a reduction in cells that make dopamine in certain parts of the brain.
Try to correct that.
That's right. And some of the side effects are, for some people, increased sexualized behavior.
Yeah.
So we can link humans to flies.
We can, in more ways than one. But, I mean, speaking of dopamine, it's something I come across it, you know, because with this theme of reward, you know, we hear about addiction. I know we're going to talk a little bit about attention spans, and this is something I've read. I unfortunately can't quote exactly who it was that said it, but it was in the press about children who sit using iPads and kind of playing games and winning. You're addicted to some game recently, weren't you?
Unfortunately, I have a Candy Crush Saga addiction, which is...
That is still in the ICD-10, that diagnosis.
Which is actually ruining my life, quite frankly.
Yeah, that's why it is
that's
actually...
That's a bit histrionic of me. It's not actually ruining my life. I'd just rather get over the addiction.
Okay, well, you do that. In the meantime, we'll get back to other people's issues with dopamine. This was a psychologist, and I will have to get the name for next time, but he was saying that all this instant rewarding, you know, with I don't know, Candy Crush or whatever it is your youngsters are doing these days, children are kind of getting used to getting what they want right now, and it's really not worth doing unless you get that instant boost, that reward, that prize, and you only do it if you get that reward. And so he was linking that with, you know, wondering maybe is that something to do with why we're seeing difficulties with attention, people not wanting to wait for things, and, you know, how does that link with rates of attention deficit disorder?
I think that's a really interesting question, and certainly I think there has been some evidence to suggest that attention spans are decreasing by a few seconds, and that's related to use of smartphones, use of computers. And there's a very small suggestion, and this requires lots of research,
mm-hmm.
It has been suggested that might underlie some of the increased rates of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder that we're seeing. Although, of course, that may be all due to the fact that more doctors and clinicians are more aware of the disorder, so it may have nothing to do with technology.
So it's just people diagnosing it more. Well, I guess, as you say, we need to... More research is needed.
Definitely more research is needed.
It's true.
And the interesting thing with the attention span story decreasing is that also there's some evidence to say that people's memories are changing and how our brains record information is changing. For example, it used to be the case that we'd all remember our home phone numbers, our parents, brothers, sisters, boyfriends, girlfriends' numbers, friends' numbers, and of course now we don't need to remember them anymore because they're all on our stored on our phones.
We should ask people to have a think now whether how many numbers they can remember. Can you remember your mum's phone number off the top of your head?
Or your home phone number?
Yeah. Depends on your relationship with your mum, I guess.
I guess. I mean, I used to be able to remember quite a few, and I remember the old ones, but I can't remember the new ones at all.
And I tend to sort of photograph things and then keep them in my head, so I'll look at the number and try to imprint it in my brain. Don't test me.
Does that work?
I don't want to be tested.
Does that work?
That's how I remember things, but I probably am worse at it now because I just don't need to do it as often.
It's curious, isn't it? And one of the things that's been shown is that people's ability to remember telephone numbers is decreasing.
It's just not needing to do it. So I guess you're not exercising your memory as much.
They say that memory and the brain is a bit like a muscle.
Yeah.
And it's about exercising it. There was that wasn't there lots of interest about 10 years ago or maybe longer, a bit shorter, in things like Sudoku and doing these tasks.
Brain training. I have a little brain training. I don't know where it is though. So that's my memory and my brain training.
Does it work?
Not working.
Does it work?
I'm very clever, so yes.
That was not serious. It's very seriously
now. You have to agree,
now.
Michael. I'm right here.
Well,
in front
very
of you.
Seriously now. Actually, you are quite clever. Actually, to be fair, Dr. Man.
Oh dear. Let's move on. Okay, so we were talking about memory, and I've noticed that today. I don't know if it's conscious, but we're being a lot more neuroscience-y than last time. Are we feeling a bit sort of Freud-y guilt or something? I don't know. We were very Freud-y last time.
Well, I don't necessarily think that it's Freud-y guilt. More perhaps that it might be neuroscience guilt, because actually we've been neglecting it. There's been lots of... And I'm actually a neuroscientist as well, so just that's...
And he's very clever.
Thank you very much. There was a recent piece in the Lancet Psychiatry which talked about the need for psychiatrists to rethink their biopsychosocial model of mental disorders. And of course, there's what's called the medical model versus, for example, a psychological model. I think in day-to-day clinical practice, I think often receives quite a bit of criticism. I don't know what your experience has been.
Yes, I mean, people come in, will see that you're a psychiatrist, and there's a very quick... From professionals, actually, typically, non-medical professionals, there'll be a kind of, well, that's a very medical model. We don't really subscribe to the medical model.
Exactly.
And I'm not quite sure what they mean by it.
Because exactly.
I'm not guilty of any of the things they seem to think I'm doing.
And I think that when people talk about the medical model, it's used in quite a pejorative sense.
Absolutely.
When I hear it. I don't hear it used positively.
I think they mean purely biological inability to think outside of biology model.
Exactly, but I think that one of the things that thinking in those terms, in very dichotomous terms,
yes,
either social models or psychological models or biological models,
yeah,
is
it
that
has nothing to do with how we practice.
Absolutely right. But what I think thinking outside of those terms does is it denies the fact that all three of them are interlinked, that anything that happens in the mind,
mm-hmm,
has an organic neural basis that happens in the brain,
whether or not we've discovered it yet.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And those things are influenced by what's happening outside of us.
Yeah.
So our psychology is influenced by what's happening in our brains, and that's going to be influenced by the social context.
Absolutely.
Because we're social beings.
Yeah.
So we know that those things are all interlinked, and so I think actually that it's right that we use a biological, psychological and social model, that a biopsychosocial model, and I think that's the medical model that I subscribe to,
mm-hmm,
and I feel actually very comfortable using that model.
I agree. I think it's important that we, I guess, get the message across that to us as practicing psychiatrists is what the medical model is about. It's about thinking broadly and bringing in aspects of bio and psycho and social into each person.
Indeed, and there's been some very recent research that I think you're going to tell us about, linking inflammatory factors and immunology to depression.
Yes, psychoneuroimmunology is an area. Well, there's been work on this for years, but there's a growing interest, I think, now. Am I right?
There is.
Yeah.
There's from the international conferences, there's enormous interest in this field at the moment. What did that paper show for Hannah?
Well, this isn't the actual an original research paper, but this was a piece in The New Scientist this week by Dara Mohammadi. And it's talking about whether an inflamed brain is the hidden cause of depression. And they talk about a particular case of somebody who'd been depressed for a long time, cycled through many different kinds of antidepressants, and then got involved in a clinical trial looking at anti-inflammatory treatments. So treatments against sort of inflammation to do with how your immune system is responding. So he then enrolled in a study of anti-inflammatory treatments for depression. So those are not like our conventional antidepressants, but instead medications targeting how your immune system is functioning. It was a study, I think, led by Claudia Busch at a medical school in Berlin in Germany. And essentially, he seemed to improve. He was given an infusion of infliximab, which is a powerful anti-inflammatory that actually is used for Crohn's disease, a sort of bowel inflammatory disease, and seemed to improve in terms of his depression. Now, of course, this was only done over 12 weeks. There were only a few patients in the trial, so it's early days. And I think with a lot of the studies that are out there, the numbers aren't huge, but it's certainly promising. And maybe for a subgroup of people, there's a suggestion that perhaps people who have chronic physical illnesses that have sort of dysregulation of their stress response or a higher baseline level of inflammatory chemicals in their bodies might be a particular subgroup of people with mental disorders that might respond to that kind of treatment.
I think this is an extremely exciting area of research at the moment. And I've seen quite a few studies now that have been presented that show links between the immune system and inflammation and a range of mental disorders. It's an extremely fascinating area of research at the moment, and it's being looked at quite a few different mental disorders. I think one of the things that's potentially interesting and something that's being researched actively at the moment is if it's possible to identify some of those patients that might be amenable to treatment that alters their immune response. And that could be things like infliximab, that,
mm-hmm,
are very powerful drugs. But of course, many standard painkillers that we take over the counter act by changing our body's inflammatory response. They're the anti-inflammatory drugs.
Yes.
And so this is being researched at the moment. I certainly wouldn't advise any listener to try any of these treatments themselves, because they need to be properly evaluated. And one of the strategies that's being investigated at the moment is by seeing if we can identify patients who might be having an inflammatory response by doing a simple blood test and seeing if perhaps in those patients that have maybe slightly elevated markers of inflammation in their routine blood tests, if by using simple anti-inflammatory drugs it might make a difference. And I think this is extremely interesting. And of course it makes sense to us because for all of us have experienced it, for example, having a cold or having the flu, and that's caused by inflammation in the body. And when we have that, we feel really lousy. Yeah. And the feelings that we have when we have that are very similar to things like depression.
Yes.
Although shorter lived and they get better more quickly. This isn't just interesting looking at depression, but also in other disorders such as psychosis and looking at what are called autoantibodies. So the body mounting an immune response against itself. There's ongoing research there, and there's a study that I've been involved in which the results are yet to be published, so I can't talk about them yet, but some
top secret,
some very exciting results that will be on the way soon.
I look forward to hearing about that. I'm actually going to give you a quote from, do you know Dr. Parianti?
Yes.
From King's? Yes. There's a quote here from New Scientist saying, blood tests for elevated cytokines might flag that it's time to unwind or be used to identify people at high risk of suicide. This is in the context of depression, for example. But Parianti's vision is that in 10 years' time, you might go to the doctor, have a blood test for inflammation, and walk out with an effective treatment. And this would be a huge leap for psychiatry.
It would be a massive leap for psychiatry. And I think one of the things that all these advances in neuroscience and this revolution in our knowledge, which is driven by advances in neuroscience, is making us question is whether mental disorders are caused by changes in the brain or not, and what that means. And going back to what we were talking about earlier in terms of a biopsychosocial model, that of course I think both of us would believe that anything that happens in the mind is also happening in the brain.
Mm.
So for us, it's a bit of a moot point. But of course, for other people, they would argue that, well, if somebody has a depression, for example, that's caused by clearly something going on in their brain, why are they seeing a psychiatrist and not a neurologist? And there was a really interesting opinion piece that you found about that.
This was an editorial in the British Journal of Psychiatry Bulletin. It was by Michael Fitzgerald. And it's entitled, Do Psychiatry and Neurology Need a Close Partnership or a Merger? He starts off saying the relationship between psychiatry and neurology remains a controversial topic. There are strong voices opposing a merger, whereas others point out that the future essentially lies with a sort of neurologist stroke psychiatrist or a neuropsychiatrist. He does a little bit of history at the start, talking about sort of similar origins of the specialties. He mentions Freud, who people kind of think about when they think about moving away from neurology, you tend to invoke images of Freud and couches, but actually Freud was a superb neuropathologist and started off
as a neurologist. In neurology.
Absolutely. I think he did his... Did he still do a study on eels and their reproductive system somewhere
Absolutely.
Along the way? I don't know why I remember that. It's important. Anyway, so he talks about... Well, he says, why are psychiatry and neurology separate? He doesn't really think they should be. He quotes George Ecos, who I think I've worked with before, who points out that neurology's expertise is the nervous system and its disorders, whereas psychiatry's expertise is affect and its disorders, whereas he doesn't agree with that at all. He doesn't really see that as an argument, because he essentially says, well, that they're not, that doesn't mean they're two separate things, really. You're not necessarily excluding discussion about the nervous system just by focusing on affect.
And of course, it's not just restricted to affect.
No,
actually,
there is
I
that.
Would say.
Yes, there is that. So he argues that our training should be together, that we should merge. In a study of trainers and trainees in psychiatry and neurology, apparently the psychiatrists were quite keen on links between neurology and psychiatry training. More so than the neurologists. So they don't really want to join us, but apparently the psychiatrists seem quite keen to merge the training.
Well, I think that there are, and of course there are many historical reasons why that's happened. So, and psychiatry is one of the only medical specialties where we undertake a purely dedicated training in that specialty from a very early stage, in a way that in other specialties they would embark on a slightly more general medical training first.
Core medical grounding.
Either, well, in the UK, there's core medical training, but there'll be an aspect of general medical training and having to undertake specialist postgraduate exams in general medicine so they can become general physicians before then specialising. That doesn't apply to psychiatry.
So and we branch off quite early.
We branch off quite early in our careers. But I think one of the things that branching off might be about, for historical reasons, it is an institutionalised discrimination against psychiatric disorders and against people who have mental health problems. If we think about psychiatric care, is always delivered in psychiatric hospitals that tend to be off-site. Mm. There are hardly any hospitals that have psychiatric, at least in this country, that have psychiatric beds, dedicated beds, in the same building.
Yeah.
They're almost always in different buildings. Their psychiatric patients are treated differently. We were talking about stigma.
Yeah.
Last time, and that I think something that psychiatrists can experience from other medical colleagues is that we're somehow not proper doctors in a way that other doctors are. I mean, what do you think about
those? Well, I mean, it's interesting you bring up the theme of sort of where our patients are housed, as it were, and the fact that here in England it's a sort of separately funded stream. They will be in a separate building. They're geographically not near the other patients. I was actually involved in this quite a few years ago. We did a little editorial. And we did a sort of pros and cons. Why, you know, should we be in the hospital, in the general hospital, or should we not? And there were arguments both ways, but overall there was a strong argument of stigma and why are we separating, why are we making this distinction? Some people will argue as we move towards having more sort of clearly defined biological bases for these illnesses, it will help reduce stigma, that people will be able to say, yes, I have this disorder. It is based on a dysregulation of whatever neurochemical in my brain. This is my treatment. It's okay. It's not the broken leg we keep coming back to, but it's more similar to a physical disorder in that sense. You talk about parity. But I think there have been studies on stigma that suggest that some people actually don't think that would reduce stigma, and some people prefer not to have that as the explanation. So, well, it's not as clear cut, I suppose.
I don't think it is. And I think that we need to also be mindful that in our attempts to biologise, to apply biological models to explain distress, which is, I think, what mental illness kind of really is about, that one of the stigmatising aspects of experiencing a mental illness is the sense that there is, if I experience a mental illness, that there is something wrong with me, and that you as the other person might, and I know you don't, this isn't the case, but in this hypothetical example, that you might then think that there's something wrong with me as a person. And I think regardless of whether that's something happening in my brain or in my personality or within me, that stigma has the potential to still arise. And actually, our way to tackle that is to continue to send a really loud and clear message that mental illnesses are illnesses. Whilst they're not like broken legs, they are like broken legs in some ways.
Yeah.
And that they can happen to anyone.
Absolutely. I was just having thought, actually, we've covered the neuro bit and wondering whether we should retrain with neurologists, but maybe we have to be doing that with the rheumatologists now, because it's all about immunology. Maybe we have to go off and, I don't know, it's all getting a bit complicated.
It is getting complicated. I think it's interesting as well, because there are increasing calls for shorter training for specialists here. And I think one of the things that this shows us is actually that perhaps we're going to need longer training, because we're going to, I think, psychiatrists of the future, to be good enough psychiatrists, are going to be able to integrate not just their psychiatric training, which includes psychological approaches, which includes social interventions and also medical treatments, but also
back on the biopsychosocial, aren't we?
Absolutely, but also having a good enough knowledge of neurology and, of course, rheumatology.
Yeah.
Exciting times.
Indeed.
Exciting
times. More work for all of us to be doing.
More work for all of us.
But for good reason.
For very good reasons. And speaking of more work, we're going to be taking a bit of a break from Mind You over the next few weeks. And you can expect to hear our next podcast in about a month or so.
Indeed. We will gather interesting topics and come up with a catchy title. It's a promise.
And we hope you've enjoyed it. And if you have enjoyed the first four episodes in our series, then please do leave us feedback. You can contact us via Twitter, Facebook, and you can also leave feedback via iTunes. So if you like our podcasts, please click like or rate and provide us with feedback, because that would be amazing.
And you can follow on at Mind You Show, at Doc Bloomfield, or at Fahana Man, if you so wish.
And that's Fahana Man with two N's at the end.
Thank you for clarifying that point.
You're very welcome. Thank you for listening.
Have a nice break.
You too. Bye-bye.